I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review in our series focusing on key data sets and publications presented over this past year. Today, we're going to be focusing on breast cancer. We have an outstanding faculty, Dr. Harold Bursing from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and Dr. Lisa Carey from the University of North Carolina. If you're into audio podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Hope Rugo on PARP inhibitors in the management of breast cancer. But we're here today to talk about breast cancer, so much to talk about. Here's where we're heading. We'll start out talking about ER-positive, HER2-negative disease, then HER2-positive disease, and then triple-negative disease. And before we even get started, I just want to bring up a big ODAC hearing, Hal, for the neoadjuvant triple-negative pembrolizumab. And from what I understand, they're going to delay making a decision on that. Not yes, not no, but just wait a little longer. Any thoughts about that, Hal? We're going to talk about that later and look at the data. But any thoughts about this FDA or this ODAC meeting?
Yeah, this was a discussion about the KEYNOTE 522 study, which was the study of neoadjuvant pembrolizumab added to a chemo backbone of AC followed by paclitaxel carboplatin. And as published a while ago now, they showed that that improved the pathologic complete response rate from around 51% to 65%, and there have been trends favoring a benefit in terms of disease-free survival. So FDA asked for an ODAC meeting to discuss whether the data were sufficient at this time to approve the drug in the setting of neoadjuvant triple-negative breast cancer, and the panel voted 10-0 to advising the FDA to defer the decision until they had more mature disease-free and overall survival data. So the drug... the FDA, of course, does not have to act in alignment with the ODAC recommendation, but there was clear sentiment in the FDA briefing materials and from the committee that we should wait for the maturation of the event-free data.
And, you know, Lisa, one of the things people, maybe they don't think they get so excited about it, the possibility of a new advance. And, you know, generally checkpoint inhibitors are very well tolerated, but there is an issue. We saw this when melanoma saw the approval in the adjuvant set in nivolumab. And then they were had to decide in the patients where BRAF is going to be IO or, you know, anti-BRAF therapy. We saw them kind of shift with time towards BRAF therapy because of their concern, even though not many side effects, about the possibility of delayed serious side effects. We have a meeting actually with Joyce O'Shaughnessy, a webinar. We're going to present a case from a doc in Washington who gave a patient neoadjuvant pembro chemo. So pretty bad neurologic sequelae from that. Any thoughts about this meeting, Lisa, and sort of where you see this heading?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, as Hal said, I think the FDA has sort of telegraphed their intention with these drugs that have a reasonable chance of long-term side effects, that they want to see actual event-free survival. They don't want to use PCR as a proxy. And that's an understandable thing for two reasons. The first is that PCR doesn't translate as directly as I think we all would like it to in terms of a quantitative benefit. And so I think getting EFS is helpful. And the second is, you know, these are drugs that you actually continue into the adjuvant setting. And so, you know, if there is a chance of a long-term toxicity, you are in fact, you know, you may be escalating it through those extra several months of therapy.
I always love talking about real cases, so interesting. And in fact, I got an email a couple of days ago from a doc in practice. This happens all the time. And we're actually going to start out with this case. But before we do, I want to see what the audience would, how they would think through this situation. So audience, you have a 52-year-old premenopausal woman. She has a big breast mass, skin changes over it, maybe not classic inflammatory, but some skin involvement. ER 35%, PR 10%, HER2 negative, grade 1. I want to know in general, what would be your approach in this situation? And how it looks like the majority of the audience, two-thirds is saying chemo, but another third is saying genomic assay first. Any thoughts about this, Hal?
Well, it's a bit of an atypical case in that it has relatively low hormone receptor expression and yet is grade 1. So that's a little unusual. also unusual premenopausal at 52. You know, I'm a big enthusiast for using genomic signatures to help decide on whether or not to offer adjuvant endocrine chemotherapy to ER-positive tumors in addition to endocrine therapy. This case sort of pushes that envelope, of course, as your cases always do, Dr. Love. That's
I always try to find analogy. That's their case. This is real world.
We find, the crevasse in the glacier. We find the mountaintop we have to climb here. You know, an 8-centimeter cancer is a big tumor in an otherwise healthy woman. I think chemotherapy is still the standard of care for stage 3 tumors, especially lower ER expression.
So just briefly, Lisa, agree or disagree? Chemo?
Agree.
Okay, so she gets chemotherapy and has almost no benefit at all. She goes to surgery. The tumor is about the same size. She's got 10 positive nodes, audience. So in addition to radiation therapy and hormonal therapy, just curious whether you'd add at some point as part of her post-op therapy capecitabine and or abemaciclib. And I'll come back to you, Lisa. Interestingly, actually, the majority of the audience is saying abemaciclib, but a lot more split on the about 50-50 about capecitabine or not in this ER-positive situation. Of course, we're much more used to using a triple negative. Lisa, capecitabine, abemaciclib, or neither?
So this is again. You're pushing us. I think with 10 involved lymph nodes, I might think about abemaciclib. But in general, I use endocrine therapy alone. I don't use capecitabine in this setting.
Hal, are you up for abemaciclib for this patient?
So we'll be talking about this, I suspect, in a moment. I really haven't been giving a lot of adjuvant abemaciclib or any other CDK4/6 inhibitor to date. I think the diagnostic test here is a CAT scan to make sure this patient doesn't have metastatic disease. But assuming they were truly stage 3, it's tempting to think about it. Of all the patients, you know, this extremely high risk situation is one you might think about it. But it is not FDA approved. It's not in any of the guidelines at the moment. And I think we perhaps still need some maturation of that data too. The follow-up, we're only with 15 to 19 months of follow-up.
Right.
So just so you don't think I'm making this up, here's the actual case from Dr. Gupta in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and here's her questions.
I want to know the role of capecitabine in this patient. She had minimal effect from neoadjuvant chemotherapy with dose-dense Adriamycin and Cytoxan and weekly Taxol. She does have a lot of residual disease, 8 centimeter in the tumor bed, and 10 out of 15 lymph nodes were positive. What would be your recommendation as far as adjuvant capecitabine is concerned? My second question would be based upon the MONARCH-E data. Would you recommend adding abemaciclib to the endocrine treatment? Obviously, I plan to give her aromatase inhibitor with ovarian suppression. I think that this would be the patient that I would think about abemaciclib, and I wanted to know your view about that.
Any other questions?
So now looking back, would you have, number one, try to do genomic testing at the time of diagnosis? So if I would have done a mamma print or an oncotype initially, and if I knew it was luminal and low-risk disease, would you think about doing neoadjuvant endocrine therapy rather than giving her toxic chemotherapy, as I discussed?
So, Lisa, you know, I always thought the idea of, you know, doing a pre-op or neoadjuvant genomic assay and, you know, using that to, even if you don't give endocrine therapy, maybe not give the chemo. I don't know. But any, have you ever do that, Lisa?
You know, not in this setting. I think in this setting, if it's clear that there isn't a number that you would get from the assay that would cause you to not give chemotherapy, and to be honest, I just don't know that there's any data about a, you know, stage 3, you know, premenopausal patient where you would avoid chemotherapy. So I wouldn't do an assay because I think it ends up, you know, don't order a test unless you are going to do something with the information.
So I met with both of the faculty separately to have their presentations recorded. They went through all the papers that, and many more that we're not going to talk about tonight. And we're posting that online along with this roundtable discussion. It's part of an on-demand program. So you can check out the detailed discussions that both Lisa and Hal did in their presentation. We picked a few of the slides. We're going to briefly go into it. We're really going to emphasize a lot, though, clinical decision-making. And we're going to start out talking about CDK inhibitors in ER-positive HER2-negative disease and how, you know, you go through all the various trials that have been done in this situation, and particularly the more later trials in the metastatic setting that are now showing survival benefit. This year, we had another one come on, the MONALEESA-3 study with ribociclib. That again demonstrated survival benefit. I'm just kind of curious what does this consistent message that we're getting from these metastatic trials mean to you? And what does the fact that you're seeing survival benefit in all three mean to you?
Well, as you say, the results for each of the three commercially available CDK4/6 inhibitors in the metastatic setting have been incredibly consistent across the multiple trials. So in first line paired with an aromatase inhibitor or in second line paired with fulvestrant, each of these drugs has shown an improvement in progression-free survival with a hazard ratio almost exactly 0.55 each time. And now with longer follow-up, we're seeing survival benefit. This slide shows that each of these drugs, palbo, ribo, and abemaciclib, have each been associated with trends or obvious survival benefits. So it's been really important for the oncology community to see that, because I think for a while there'd been a certain degree of nihilism in management of ER-positive breast cancer that you couldn't see survival, that there were so many lines of therapy, or that the drugs truthfully probably weren't effective enough that you just couldn't get a survival advantage. So that's been really encouraging. And the other endpoint in the metastatic setting that's been really important is each of these trials has shown that you can actually defer the initiation of chemotherapy. And for our patients, being able to stay on an endocrine regimen, which is portable, which is oral, has been hugely important, especially during the pandemic this past year. So these drugs are, you know, well ensconced as a standard part of metastatic disease. And obviously, we're going to be looking at data that have come forward this past year for their use in early stage breast cancer as well.
And so, Lisa, that does bring up the controversy that we were just alluding to. We had the MONARCH E study presented at ESMO. Very high-risk patients, but a hazard rate for disease-free survival of 0.75, so 25% relative reduction. But we did not see it in the PALLAS trial with PALBO, curves completely overlapping, as well as the PENELOPE-B study. How do you put this all together, Lisa? Where do you think it's heading?
Well, you know, I think it's going to mature. I think as Hal alluded to, and you know, MONARCH E was, you know, certainly exciting, but it's also very early. And PENELOPE at a similar time point, actually, also the curves were split at that point. So whether this is a transient thing that's a benefit of looking very early and doesn't last, I think we'll know shortly. You know, it's also true that while the hazard ratios in the metastatic setting are virtually identical. They all seem to have a trend in, you know, close to each other in terms of all the endpoints, even survival. They aren't the same drugs, right? And in particular, abemaciclib has a different, slightly different mechanism. It hits, you know, a broader array of the, you know, cyclin-relevant CDKs. And so whether the fact that it has a different profile is playing a role here, whether it's just play of chance, you know, we don't quite know, but it, you know, the data are what they are.
So to be continued. I think after seeing slides like you put up there, how showing how similar things are in the metastatic setting, I think Lisa points very, very well taken. The things may be different in the adjuvant situation, maybe a different mutational profile, who knows what. I want to just also touch base a little bit about PI3 kinase inhibition, and of course, alpelisib now is an alternative. Just kind of curious, audience, what's your second line therapy after CDK and endocrine therapy? We said palbo, letrozole, assuming the patient is a PIK3 mutation, audience. Are you going to go with alpelisib? You know, everolimus would be another possibility that could be considered. Seems like the majority of the audience is going to go with alpelisib and fulvestrant, assuming this patient needs to have a switch in therapy. Hal, I'm just kind of curious, do you always go to alpelisib and fulvestrant? I mean, do you believe the data is better than everolimus, for example?
That's an interesting question, and one that hasn't been studied in a head-to-head comparison. You know, the biochemical pathways for mTOR inhibition and PI3 kinase kind of funnel into very similar sort of cell signaling pathways. So whether one is really different or better than the other is an interesting question. you know, I certainly do use alpelisib in second line with fulvestrant for a woman whose tumor has a PIK3CA mutation. The data from the SOLAR-1 trial were fairly compelling in terms of progression-free survival. They presented an update this year, and as far as we can tell, there's no actual survival benefit in that trial, even in the cohort of women with the PI3 kinase mutation. The big challenge with the drug is the tolerability, and as the audience probably knows, here's the primary data for the PIK3CA mutated carriers. The issue is that there's a lot of hyperglycemia and skin rash. So we now prophylax all patients with an antihistamine, and one of the data sets that came forward this year was a nice study, the BELIEVE trial here that Hope Rugo and others were involved with, where they prophylaxed people with antihistamines and showed that there was obviously a lower incidence of the rash. The hyperglycemia is also a challenge. So if you don't like managing hyperglycemia in your outpatient oncology clinic, you need your endocrinology friend to help you out, because almost all these patients develop laboratory hyperglycemia and require some degree of intervention with some of the familiar antihyperglycemic agents.
Oncologists need a lot of friends nowadays. Now I'm hearing more about ophthalmology, you know, ophthalmic complications, like five different tumor types, different new agents. Lisa, just to pick up in terms of your experience with alpelisib, and we actually have a poll question for the audience about this issue of hyperglycemia. Audience, so you have a patient where you want to give alpelisib, fasting glucose 130, hemoglobin A1c 6.5. Would you give the alpelisib? Would you reduce the dose? Lisa, any thoughts about this issue of managing these patients? Do you get an endocrinologist involved in many or any of these cases?
I do. I mean, I think, you know, as Hal points out, this is a, you know, common problem. It could be a very good primary care physician, but you do want your partner involved, you know, or it could be a great CPP who's happy with managing, you know, helping you to manage these things, but you need some friends.
Always Neil, I see that. Actually, we have a question about interstitial lung disease with these targeted drugs. And it's a really important point for people to remind themselves that all of these drugs carry risks of pneumonitis. So the checkpoint inhibitors, people are sort of getting more and more familiar with that story. But there's actually a warning for CDK4/6 inhibitors in the FDA insert about pneumonitis. And of course, everolimus and alpelisib are also associated with that. So patients who have respiratory symptoms or atypical infiltrates on a CT scan, most likely it's probably COVID these days, but you have to think about interstitial lung disease as well. It's a good question.
Yeah, no, I was going to say COVID is making pneumonitis a much more complicated workup nowadays. Before we go on to the final topic in this section, just want to get back to the audience answered about the alpelisib thing, Lisa. So everybody said with that case that they would use alpelisib, but about a third of the audience says that reduced dose. Would you reduce the dose, for example, in a diabetic, Lisa?
In a brittle diabetic, I would. I think typically I start at standard dose unless there's something that makes me super concerned.
Okay, so another big presentation from San Antonio was the much-awaited RxPONDER trial. And so audience, you got a premenopausal patient, ER positive, HER2 negative, two positive nodes. Would you get a genomic assay in this patient or just go ahead and treat with chemotherapy? Looks, Hal, like actually about two-thirds of the audience would get an assay, which means I guess they would consider not giving chemo. Most of them say the 21 gene, but 10% say the 70 gene signature. And of course, we saw the RxPONDER. So first of all, Hal, how would you answer the question we just answered the audience? Are you, let's put aside reimbursement and all, would you like to get a genomic assay in a patient with two positive nodes or premenopausal woman?
Yeah. So first of all, before we dive into the small subset, let's not miss the forest for the trees. RxPONDER is a really important data. And what they showed is that women who have 1 to 3 positive nodes for ER positive, HER2 negative breast cancer, prospective randomized trial, endocrine therapy alone versus endocrine therapy plus chemotherapy, overall negligible benefit for chemotherapy, a 1% difference. Take a deep breath. That's a really important result, entirely square with the Taylor X data in node negative. Okay, we're oncologists. We don't like simple answers. We like complicated answers. So postmenopausal patients, absolutely no benefit. So the standard of care now for a woman who's got 1 to 3 positive nodes postmenopausal, which is the vast majority of cases of breast cancer, we're getting genomic testing with the recurrence score. what about premenopausal patients? So what they saw in RXBonder, very similar to what they saw in Taylor X, is that there is a numerical benefit in RXBonder, it's about 4%, 5%, favoring chemotherapy in premenopausal patients. And that was true regardless of the range of the score, 0 to 13 or 14 to 25. And it was true regardless of one node or two or three positive nodes. So that's really interesting. And the question that persists after this and similar data in Taylor X is how much of that difference is due to ovarian suppression? And my personal guess is that the vast majority of it is due to the effects of ovarian suppression. So I think that for most women who have a 2.1 centimeter cancer and a metastasis in a node, getting a recurrence score is an excellent idea. And if it's really low or less than 25 in most cases, I maximize endocrine therapy with ovarian suppression and probably in AI, and I think there's marginal, if any, benefit for chemo. There are people, and who really are uncomfortable with that, and they point out that, which is true, that the numbers favor chemotherapy in this premenopausal cohort, and so that's a really important discussion to have. I think it's helpful to look at other pieces of data too. What's the tumor grade? What's the extent of the lymph node involvement? And of course, what are the patient preferences? Because I do think that these data tell us we're really winnowing down the benefit to being a pretty small number. And if you're not hugely motivated to accept chemotherapy for what could be nothing and is likely very small, then that's an important discussion. But don't miss the big picture. RXBonder, very important study. Postmenopausal, 1 to 3 positive nodes. Recurrent score testing, and we're not giving chemo if it's less than 25.
So, Lisa, I see a question just came in the chat room from Karen Green. Do you recommend adjuvant chemo or OSAI for premenopausal woman with oncotype of 10, microscopic, micrometastatic focus in one lymph node?
Yeah, that's a patient with one micromet. I think, previously these are patients in whom the recurrence score had reasonable data. I think the problem with the responder trial is that, we would like to believe that the reason that the premenopausal behaved differently in the postmenopausal is because of the impact of ovarian suppression. I have no doubt that that's at least part of it, but I don't know how much it is, how much of a part of it is. And the question of whether you can supplant ovarian suppression for the chemo and get the same 5% benefit wasn't tested in the trial. And in truth, most patients say that, and I think many of us would feel that a 5% difference is considered clinically meaningful. So, I think in the end of the day, we will have a more sophisticated tool. I also believe that there are upfront elements of the tumor that will give us a better hint of who within the premenopausal group would benefit more from chemotherapy or those in whom ovarian suppression is adequate. Unfortunately, I don't think we can tell that from responder, which, in that setting, essentially the genomic assay did not help us at all, which surprised me, to be honest. I thought there would be a hint of an interaction, but...
So my take on that is that the interaction is missing because it's largely an ovarian suppression effect. And that would account for the lack of difference for the low range scores and the higher scores. If you look at the soft data, the benefits of chemotherapy in RXBonder are very much on par in magnitude with the benefit of ovarian suppression and an AI compared to tamoxifen alone in the soft study. And I take Lisa's point that we probably need a little more clarity for these higher risk groups. But at the same time, if you imagine that there's a role for chemo, you have to think about what is it beside from ER, nodal status, grade, Ki-67, all of which are built into the recurrence score that accounts for that difference and why premenopausal women would not benefit and would benefit and postmenopausal women don't. It's hard to know what that would be at this point.
All right, we're moving on to her too. Real quick though, I can't resist another case that just popped in here. So just real quick, 70-year-old woman, HER2-positive breast cancer, gets adjuvant chemo and anti-HER therapy. 1 year later, develops liver mets. Liver biopsy shows the tumor looks the same, except now it's HER2 negative. Should anti-HER therapy be included at this point?
So these are complicated cases when the HER2 test changes. If you really think it was positive at baseline, I would typically offer some kind of chemotherapy plus anti-HER2 therapy at this point with the liver metastases, though it's a little unusual to have recurrence so quickly these days after effective adjuvant anti-HER2 treatment. So, you know, it's hard to know which one is the truth. There can certainly be tumor heterogeneity, and these can select out clones that will propagate one way or the other. But I would probably give at least one more effort at anti-HER2 treatment and then look for a chance to re-biopsy later.
So just real quick, Lisa, what are you doing nowadays for, simple question, I guess. What are you doing nowadays for node positive, HER2 positive disease in the adjuvant setting? Really, I want to know, are you using pertuzumab? And in this situation where you have a patient with two positive nodes who's ER positive, do you think you'd likely would present neratinib?
So most of these patients I would treat neoadjuvantly. And so then you have the opportunity. And in a node positive patient, I would include pertuzumab. You know, I think the affinity data are pretty clear about the benefit there. And then if there's residual disease, you would use T-DM1 or trastuzumab emtansine. You know, neratinib, I think, you know, in that setting, there's really very little data regarding the benefit of neratinib in that setting. And I typically wouldn't unless there were multiple nodes involved.
So Hal, maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the data that came out about neratinib. These were, Lisa went through this in her talk in terms of more data from the Extenet study. What really struck me was the fact that the five-year CNS relapse rate was decreased. It looks like fairly significantly. Any thoughts about this follow-up data, Hal?
Well, obviously, it's terrific that they continue to follow these patients and provide these updates. And I think a couple points just to hit. The first is that, you know, the prognosis for early stage HER2 positive breast cancer is really good these days. And while we obviously don't want to see any CNS relapses, for instance, we're down to, you know, essentially a 1% to 2% risk, which is excellent. There was a paper that just came out updated on the affinity study from Martine Picard in the JCO for node negative HER2 positive breast cancer. The six-year disease-free survival is now 95%. It's an extraordinary thing. I'm with Lisa on this one. I think most patients who have node-positive disease are getting pertuzumab-based therapy. If they get in the neoadjuvant setting, they're additionally getting trastuzumab emtansine if they have residual disease. There are really no data on whether neratinib adds to that. So it takes a really extreme case by stage where I would be adding the neratinib to the treatment.
I am curious, though, Lisa, I just showed some slides, including this one, in terms of, you know, some of the mitigation strategies come out in terms of the diarrhea with neratinib, of course, not just used in the post-adjuvant setting, but also metastatic. How has this played out in your practice, Lisa?
You know, in my practice, if I use neratinib, I use a dose escalation strategy. It was the easiest to do. It doesn't involve multiple drugs, and it was the most effective in the control trial. So I think, you know, you start at half dose and you go up over the course of a couple of weeks to full dose, and that's actually seems to help a lot.
So let's jump into metastatic disease, where we've been talking a lot about it since the San Antonio 2019. I was looking back at that conference where trastuzumab deruxtecan didn't even have a name. Can you believe that? I feel like I've been talking about it every day now since then. But anyhow, so audience, we got a couple of metastatic scenarios in the third line where all the controversy is. So here's the first one. You got a patient who gets THP first line, T-DM1, and now has disease progression. I'm going to say a lot of disease, symptomatic disease, okay? So what's your third line therapy in this situation? And Hal, it looks like a consensus in the audience. They're split 50-50 actually between HerClimb and TDXD. How do you think it through, Hal?
America is a divided country. you know, there's no right or answer on this. Trastuzumab deruxtecan, obviously a very high response rate, 60% in their open label phase 2 study, arguably the most potent drug we've seen in HER2 positive advanced breast cancer. And yet, tucatinib based regimen with trastuzumab and capecitabine has a survival benefit in a well conducted phase 3 trial and clearly has CNS penetration. The other point is that, of course, deruxtecan is more like getting chemotherapy. I mean, it's just a more toxic experience on a day to day patient. So, patients who need a response urgently, I typically go with trastuzumab deruxtecan. Patients with CNS disease, patients who want to not lose their hair, patients who, because a lot of them are coming off trastuzumab emtansine, which also does not cause alopecia. So I think for them, the tucatinib-based regimen is a really nice option. But there's no head-to-head study at the moment.
So mull over this one while I'm going to get back to Hal in a second. But while we're doing that, now you've got a patient who, same thing, on T-DM1 second line and develops a brain met that gets resected. No other progression, no other disease. Would you keep the T-DM1 going or would you switch? While they're voting, Hal, just to get back to you about chemo side effects of T-DXd, because I haven't heard too much about it. You see hair loss, nausea, I mean, chemo effects? I wasn't aware of that.
You can see some of that with this drug, and there's some myelosuppression as well. And of course, we're still sorting out, but this is another drug that carries a risk of pneumonitis and requires vigilant monitoring for pneumonitis. So it's just it's not, by oncology standards, it's a very doable drug, but it is a drug that requires a little more in the way of traditional side effects. At least that's been my experience with it.
So, Lisa, to get back to the situation where the patient develops a brain met that's resected on T-DM1, I think the current, if it's still the current one, unless they came out with one since I saw, guidelines would say keep the T-DM1 going if the systemic disease is controlled. But, of course, now, since those guidelines were written, you have a really effective therapy in the CNS. And, in fact, that's what by far the majority of the audience would switch to her climb. How do you think this went through, Lisa?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it isn't a wrong decision. I think the guidelines basically are playing the long game. So if you have a isolated brain met and, you know, they have resected it, so now you have removed that and the remainder of the disease is stable, then, you know, you may buy several more months, before anything happens. I think, you know, you should assume that you'll be moving on at some point, but you may have bought some time. And so I generally go with, you know, the guideline-based approaches. I do think we're going to have additional information about whether patients may do better with earlier initiation, even in the setting of having been rendered essentially NED from the brain standpoint. But at the moment, I tend to go conservative.
And am I correct in saying, Lisa, that there is or is being planned a phase 3 trial of second-line therapy of T-DM1 versus tucatinib as second-line therapy?
There absolutely is. And in truth, actually, there's an adjuvant trial, too, that just activated, the COMPASS-RD, which is the residual disease setting T-DM1 with or without tucatinib. So it'll be asking that question.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I like that one. So Hal, here's Lisa's slide. So I'm going through the HER-CLIMB study, but what we saw this year was a lot more data on the CNS activity of it, and the big JCO paper that came out, really impressive CNS activity. Anything you want to add in terms of your clinical experience with this approach, Hal, and also tolerability issues?
Well, first, a shout out to my Dana-Farber colleague, Nancy Lin, who reported these data. And Nancy has, over the past decade, done a series of clinical trials really aimed at treating HER2-positive metastatic disease in the brain, and I think shown really compelling data that many agents and regimens can be effective there. And so, you know, one of the reasons patients with HER2-positive disease are living a really long time in the metastatic setting is because of better control of the CNS. So I think these data make it very appealing to offer this regimen to patients who have CNS disease. In the particular vignette that was mentioned, I think you can go either way. I mean, they have minimal disease progression elsewhere. If they're beautifully tolerating the trastuzumab emtansine, I think it'd be very reasonable to continue after palliating the brain. But these data look really good to my eye for women who have active CNS mets.
So Lisa, also curious about your experience with this regimen in terms of tolerability, and also a common question I get from oncologists. And a patient has already had capecitabine. Sometimes they're progressing on capecitabine. Do you need to use the capecitabine? They tell me it's hard to get it from the insurers unless you give capecitabine. Any thoughts about that, Lisa?
Yeah, I mean, typically I do incorporate it. If the patient's already progressed on capecitabine, that might help you with the decision regarding TDXD, right? If for some reason you don't want to give it. I suspect that tucatinib is going to be, as we know, it's going to be combined with a lot of different things, and there'll be data coming out. I try and stick to the regimen as it was tested in HER2CLIMB when at all possible.
All right, let's talk a little bit about TDXD and Hal. I feel like I'm talking about this all the time because the lung people we're talking about, the GI people, the bladder people, and HER2s. I'm wondering, do you think we're moving towards a situation, Hal, where there's going to be sort of an MSI high non-tumor HER2 approach so that we might be evolving towards?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, these targeted drugs are perhaps not untargeted, but a little less rigidly targeted than we'd imagine, because normal tissues express some HER2 and other tumors do as well. So there have been data for this drug now in the GI tumors, as you alluded to, and perhaps the lung tumors. Very similar story that we'll get to for the sacituzumab data, where TROP2 as a target didn't really predict benefit in the quantitative way. So, the company's been very clever here. They've started with the approval in the HER2 strongly positives. They're doing studies to look at its role in HER2 low type. Lisa's better on this stuff than I am, but you know, the question is there really a biological subset of HER2 low cancers, or is it just that there's some low level of expression of HER2 that they're able to clinically take advantage of in that setting? And that's going to be really interesting to see what emerges. And so the drug is active in many contexts, as you've alluded to.
So Lisa, you know, the strange thing is, you know, in breast cancer, it's amplified patients mainly. Mm-hmm. In lung cancer, it's mutated patients. Gastric, it was just approved with amplified overexpress. In colon, they're still discussing. So it seems like theoretically it might hit both mutants and overexpression. Any thoughts, again, Lisa, about whether or not, you know, we'll be able to look at maybe a, you know, some other tumor that has HER2? I mean, you're talking about sacituzumab. Now the bladder people are talking about sacituzumab. Any thoughts about where this is all heading, Lisa?
Well, you know, I think as Hal was alluding, it's heading, it looks like it's heading towards really pretty broad use. And I think, you know, one way to think about this, it's possible that these kind of drugs, they don't really need to be therapeutic antibodies. They just need the protein to grab onto and to deliver their payload. So it's possible that these will be much easier to use from the standpoint of not needing a restrictive biomarker. You just need some presence of that protein. But I think this is a really exciting time. And it wouldn't surprise me if at some point there will be a, you know, almost a tumor type agnostic approach with many of these drugs.
And so we actually saw some more data on TDXD and breast cancer this year. If anything, it looks like the waterfall plot's even looking better with more follow-up. It's really incredible. But of course, Hal, the issue comes up about the potential for interstitial lung disease. And again, it's been very interesting to see, like, the lung people, they don't seem too concerned about it because they deal with pneumonitis and COPD stuff all day long. Other people, I've heard people in breast cancer say, you know, we want to look at the scans very carefully. Maybe I've heard people doing DLCOs to try to pick up pneumonitis earlier. Any thoughts about this ILD, Harold?
The interesting thing is that, you know, the drug is approved, and I really do think that we should ask the company for a more straightforward, you know, treatment experience to both quantify the risk and to prospectively demonstrate that there's an algorithm for testing that works. It's a serious side effect. There were several deaths on trial. I think that, you know, given the potency of the drug, it's a drug we want to make sure we're giving safely, but we want to make sure we're giving. So what we really need is a larger prospective experience to say, if you follow this guidance for evaluating this, your patients will not have a problem, or you will detect it early. So that's what we should be doing, and it would be great if they had that for us.
So interesting to see the different cultures. You know, the lung people want to give it first line. You know, they're used to, you have a target, you have a 60% response rate, it's going ahead of chemo. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but they're talking about it already. It's not even approved. So interesting in terms of the different cultures you see that general medical oncologists being exposed to all the time. Of course, we are too. In the Anyhow, Lisa, I think I saw some questions. Yeah, there's, when do you consider margetuximab? That's actually our next topic, and actually now FDA approved, Lisa. So what is margetuximab, and when would you think about using it?
Yeah, so margetuximab is a, you know, basically a, you know, a feat of biomedical engineering. So it's an Fc engineered gamma receptor that is helps with the low affinity alleles for the activating CD16A, and it just has a better binding to it. And in SOPHIA, which is the trial you're actually showing right here, compared to trastuzumab, it, you know, had a modest but appeared to have some improvement over trastuzumab. It's essentially otherwise a very similar drug. And I think it was approved a little bit, you know, surprisingly to me, you know, without a genotyping element, without an integral biomarker. And the reason that surprised me a little bit, was because what you see on the bottom, which is actually in the higher affinity allele, actually the PFS was reversed in its directionality in terms of trastuzumab seemed to outperform. These are early days. I think it's being studied in a number of trials. I think it should be studied. I think whether we can, you know, improve on trastuzumab is because that's really what this is. It's just trastuzumab. It's a better, you know, form of it if it lives up to promise. But at the moment, you know, I'm not sure what to do with it in terms of genotyping. And I think many people are probably awaiting additional data, as am I.
Okay, let's talk about triple negative briefly. Again, we have and talked about this for hours at a time. But audience, let's see where you're at. So you've got a young patient who gets neoadjuvant chemotherapy for triple negative disease post-op radiation. 20 months later has metastatic disease, liver and nodes, BRCA wild type, PD-L1 positive. Curious, it looks, how the audience in general, even though there are two alternatives that a lot of people might consider, the audience is mainly saying atezo-nab with a minority, only 15% saying pembro-nab paclitaxel. That's interesting. So Hal, any thoughts about this? What would you likely do in this kind of situation?
So obviously you're going to give chemotherapy with a checkpoint inhibitor. I think either is reasonable. Lisa has pointed out in her discussion that the IMPASSION data for the use of atezolizumab was associated with an overall survival benefit. And I think that's probably a good point and gives pride of place to the atezo-nab-paclitaxel combination right now. One thing that is important for the audience to remember, there was a negative study looking at paclitaxel plus atezolizumab. So you don't want to give just plain paclitaxel with atezo. And you know, the combination of the gemcitabine, carboplatin, and pembro is an option. We sometimes give it in the patients who are immediately recurring after, say, ACT chemotherapy. But the outcomes were less good with that, probably because of selection of tumors that were progressively resistant. I think that's who was offered the gemcitabine carboplatin regimen.
So, Lisa, here are some of the slides in your presentation that go through. We're not going to go through either all these trials. I guess one thing I was curious about is Hal was pointing out, you know, whether there's sort of outliers, you kind of wonder about it. And of course, we saw the approval of pembrolizumab in November. But also the issue, we'll get to it in a second, of the atezo-paclitaxel trial that wasn't positive. Any thoughts about that, Lisa? It was a kind of small numbers of patients. Any thoughts about what was going on there?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I mean, there was some thinking that maybe it's paclitaxel, right, when it first came out. But the truth is, if you look, these are small numbers, but it certainly doesn't suggest that there's a problem with giving paclitaxel with an immune checkpoint inhibitor, at least as long as that immune checkpoint inhibitor is pembro. Now, I mean, we have to be careful with cross-trial comparisons. And the truth is that the, you know, PFS hazard ratio confidence intervals overlapped in IMPASSION 131 and KEYNOTE 522. So this could just be statistical chance. To be honest, I don't actually know why atezo, I haven't heard a biologically plausible reason why there would be a different effect if you're using pembro versus atezo. I'm not sure the PD-1, PD-L1 explanation really, you know, seems to be germane here. So I think you have to go with the data. I, like Hal, wouldn't combine paclitaxel with atezo for the reason of that trial. But I don't see there's a reason not to do it. And to be honest, I just don't use paclitaxel with immune checkpoint inhibitors because it makes me nervous. I just use nab-paclitaxel.
Because you don't want to give the steroids?
Because I don't want to give the steroids because we have a big, well-controlled study, you know, 131, that was flat out negative. The subset analysis of the KEYNOTE study is a subset analysis. And so we have other choices.
And we want to get also into the issue we were talking about at the beginning, because I think this is maybe one of the most common questions we get about the management of breast cancer, period, let alone triple negative disease. So audience, just kind of curious, have you given neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitor outside a clinical trial? We gave this situation, but I just want to know in general, have you done it? If you haven't done it, do you think there's a patient out there or a situation where you might do it outside a trial setting, or are you going to sit like the faculty and wait when the FDA, I guess, and wait for more data? And actually, Hal, it looks like the majority, more than half of the audience has either done it or more likely would for the right patient. Hal, have you given a checkpoint inhibitor in this setting outside a trial?
Not outside of trials. I mean, I'm not sure what we mean by the right patient. You know, there's no marker to tell you who the right patient is or the wrong patient is. I know that, you know, triple negative disease remains a challenging disease. And this was the, for people who are interested in such things, the ODAC meeting today, which will be archived and available, was fascinating because there were patient advocates speaking about, you know, the urgency of treatment for triple negative cancer. And there were statisticians who were pointing out that this study doesn't tell us what we want to know right now. And I do expect that with maturation of the data, it'll be a lot more clear. And obviously, we hope that this proves to be an important step forward for our patients. But in that trial, the vast majority of patients really are cured of their disease, at least in the follow-up. And a couple things that came out in the ODAC meeting, which we shouldn't forget. One is there were 1% of patients who died from the regimen, which is not a trivial thing. The second is that 15% of patients had permanent endocrinopathy. So this is usually hypothyroidism, but also included panhypopituitarism, adrenal insufficiency, and it can include diabetes. So you have to really know in the early stage setting what the benefit is going to be for patients. And I just don't think we have that information yet. So there was no difference in breast conserving surgery rates in these trials. So there's no patient out there who you can really say for sure we know it's going to improve things. My guess is that with maturation of this and other studies of checkpoint inhibitors, we will see a benefit. I think that's where things are going. But I don't think it's a standard of care today. Maybe it will be in a few months.
Lisa, any thoughts? We have the data here from these trials, particularly the 522. Also, we've seen data with atezolizumab showing improvement in PCR, but also more follow-up with the Pembro. Any thoughts about anything you would say about this? And also, here's some more data, what you were talking about, Lisa, in terms of complications.
Yeah, you know, I have to say I have the same trepidation about these drugs that Hal was outlining, and I think that probably is driving the concern. I mean, these are, you know, the PCR advantage, you know, which was seen with both Pembro and with Atezo in the two largest trials, you know, is real, and that can be clinically meaningful. However, is that usually in triple negative, you have given your drugs and you aren't continuing a drug well into the future. And these side effects can be long lasting and are really different. You know, I have a patient right now that we're wrestling with probably neurosarcoidosis. She had metastatic disease and got a ICI for that. And I thought she had developed leptomeningeal disease, but she probably actually has neurosarcoid. I just thought it might be neuritis when all of her CTCs, when her TAPs had come back. But the point is, you can get all sorts of very difficult things. So I think we have to be mindful of that. And I think a PCR advantage itself is not enough for me. I think if you have a locally advanced tumor that's inoperable, you could make an argument that you need to get them to operability and this might help. But I think it's a really hard sell otherwise until they show an EFS advantage that's clear cut. And then you're going to have to weigh, right? You have to weigh toxicity of all the itises. And there were a lot of itises and most of them were not thyroid versus a benefit once we know that quantitative measure.
So here are the data we were talking about with atezolizumab, also showing path CR. I'm curious how, I think the first time the FDA used PCR as an endpoint was with HER2 neoadjuvant therapy. Do you think that there's kind of like pulling back from that because it maybe didn't play out as well as they thought?
I think they very much are. And I actually read that as an important lesson for investigators, pharmaceutical companies today, that simply showing in a well-done randomized trial that you have boosted the PCR rate may not be enough. And I thought they actually gave a roadmap for what they were looking for. First, they wanted to, for accelerated approval, they want an extraordinary drug, something that really has a dramatic impact on PCR rates. And at some point, that's an eye of the beholder thing, but they want a big difference. Second, they want proven efficacy in the metastatic setting with a major survival benefit that tracks along with what they saw. They had that with pertuzumab. It was not so clear with the checkpoint inhibitors because, as we were just discussing, it's only in the PD-1s where you see the survival benefit in the metastatic setting. Third, they had real concerns about the toxicity in the early stage. And this is going to have a big impact on the design of many clinical trials in the coming years because it's raised the bar for what a neoadjuvant study needs to report before they can consider an accelerated approval.
So speaking of extraordinary drugs, having just spent an hour with docs talking about PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer, they have some pretty nice hazard rates there. So audience, you got a 60-year-old patient who's got a BRCA germline mutation, de novo triple negative breast cancer that's PD-L1 negative. So as this is another one of these things that never happen in real life, but I know it does. But in any event, so the audience is really split, Lisa, about what to do. Actually, most of the audience is actually saying PARP inhibitor. The rest saying chemotherapy, either and actually a fair number of people saying chemo followed by maintenance PARP. I don't think you even have studied that, but they do that all day long in ovarian cancer, and what incredible results they see. So it looks like actually, Lisa, I'm guessing, well, what do you usually do in this situation? Chemo, Lisa?
Well, I actually usually start with chemo, but to be honest, I think this is a coin toss. You know, the reason to start with chemo is because the trials that examined PARP inhibitors typically did it, you know, versus second line choices of chemotherapy. On the other hand, these are well tolerated drugs. You're going to use them at some point, and they certainly are much easier for the patient. Now, whether they're better or not, I think is, completely, not yet studied in truth. And in particular, they were never studied against, a platinum drug, in the first line setting. So, I think that's where the rubber is going to hit the road. Now, I think the people who said chemo followed by, maybe reacting to the Brocade 3 data with veliparib, where they gave it with the chemo and then following the chemo. But in truth, if you look, the curves start to split at the point at which the chemo ended and patients were either on nothing or they were on veliparib. So that may be probably driving that choice.
So Hal, in terms of data that came out at the ASCO meeting, we saw an interesting study. Of course, this has been studied a lot in ovarian cancer, somatic mutations, non-PARP, non-BRCA mutations. But maybe you can talk a little bit about this presentation that now you're looking at breast cancer.
So I got to say, this is my favorite sleeper trial of the year. this is TBCRC048, which Nadine Tung, my friend and colleague at Beth Israel across the street, led. And so this was a trial of patients who had either a non-BRCA hereditary mutation like ATM, CHEK2, PALB2, et cetera, or had a somatic mutation in BRCA1 or 2 in the tumor. So here are the data people are looking at for the mutations. Interestingly, no real responses in ATM or CHEK2, but if you have a PALB2 hereditary mutation, 9 of the 11 patients had a response, which is to say, olaparib in PALB2-associated breast cancer is the single most active drug we have in metastatic breast cancer. And a reminder that most of these patients have ER-positive tumors. You get PALB2 and BRCA2 get the normal distribution of breast cancer, so most are ER positive, not triple negative. The data shown now for the somatic mutations were intriguing. About half the patients whose tumors had a somatic BRCA1 or 2 mutation also had a clinical response, 8 out of 16 patients or so. So what's happened in the past couple of years is PARP inhibitors have really shown that if you have a DNA repair pathway mutation like BRCA1, BRCA2, PALB2, that's true in prostate, it's true in breast, it's true in ovarian. These are really good drugs. And intriguingly, they now look to be active in that subset with somatic mutations as well. I think this means three things. One is we should be thinking about these drugs in our patients. And then two corollaries, that means every patient with metastatic breast cancer needs panel testing for hereditary risk. And increasingly, we're talking about whole genome sequencing for somatic mutations in the tumor as well. And this is obviously a small cohort of patients, but a very active class of drugs for such patients.
I always like the idea of PALB2 because it's like BRCA's pal, they tell
exactly.
me. That's about my level of translational understanding. So Lisa, I'm kind of curious, how's colleagues in gynecologic oncology, Ursula Matulonis and Joyce Liu, talk about the HRD state? And actually in ovarian, they have these HRD assays they do. Is that something that you would think about in a patient with breast cancer?
Yeah, the HRD assays per se don't seem to perform in breast cancer the way they do in ovarian cancer. And so I think that's still an opportunity to try and find, I think, what we used to call in the olden days, BRCA ness. So patients who have a deficiency in that form of DNA repair, but don't actually have BRCA1 or 2, either germline or somatic, acquisition of mutations. you know, there are a couple of different ways of doing this. One is to see if there is some constellation of genomic aberrations that would create a mimicking, BRCA mimicking situation. The second is whether you can take another drug and try and force a tumor into behaving as if it has homologous recombination deficiency. Those are all things that are being studied. At the moment, we haven't seen a lot of evidence that PARP inhibitors will work outside of the things that Hal just outlined, which are really either somatic or germline aberrations that are picked up in these hereditary panels.
So final word about sacituzumab. Just want to ask the audience in general right now, you've got a patient with metastatic disease, BRCA wild type, PD-L1 positive. They've gotten atezo-nab first line. I want to know what's second line right now in your practice. And Hal, I'm seeing a lot of sacituzumab. I see some eribulin there also. How do you answer this one, Hal?
Well, the data from the ASCENT trial were pretty compelling this year. That was a randomized study comparing sacituzumab against a dealer's choice of chemotherapies, which included eribulin, capecitabine, vinorelbine, gemcitabine, and it outperformed them. There was a survival advantage favoring the sacituzumab, which corroborated the phase two open label data that you're showing here with a response rate of 33%. So I think that since most patients who have triple negative disease will have already had therapy in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting, they've typically seen an anthracycline, an alkylator, a taxane. They've now recurred. They get first-line chemo. I think sacituzumab is a very appropriate second-line choice.